But you couldn't pick a route in North Carolina that impacted more Native people, right? And so, like, I think people were outraged that there were so many Native people in the federally defined impact area, yet there was no discussion of that whatsoever in the draft environmental impact statement.
That was a clip from my interview with Dr. Ryan Emanuel. He is a Lumbee Associate Professor at North Carolina State in the Department of Forestry and Environmental Resources. In this episode, we discuss the Atlantic Pipeline and the recent decision to cancel its construction on July 7th, 2020. The pipeline began in 2013 under the Obama administration. It was projected to be 600 miles crossing from Virginia, West Virginia, and North Carolina. The Atlantic Pipeline was described as an energy provider and job creator for the region. Those opposed to the pipeline say its presence would have disrupted the water and ecosystem while being a threat to poor, rural, Black, and Indigenous communities in the states. The cancellation comes as a big win for the networks who organized against it. Included in this network are Indigenous peoples from the surrounding nations. Dr. Emanuel and I discussed the pipeline's history, Indigenous peoples' resistance, what the win means for Indigenous peoples in the region, and the importance of building resistance within and with different communities. Thank you to Dr. Emanuel for taking the time to talk to me and our listeners for tuning in. I've also included links to Dr. Ryan Emanuel's website and articles in the show notes. Thank you. This is the Wish Day Podcast.
So in mid-2017, 3 years ago, pipeline developers came and gave a presentation to the North Carolina Commission of Indian Affairs. Right before their presentation, a Lumbee woman came and showed a short video that she had either produced or helped in some way on DAPL. And this was right after the evacuation of the camps at Standing Rock, and they're probably just completing the Missouri River crossing at that time. And she showed the commissioners this short video of DAPL, and it included the fire hosing of water protectors back in November the year before. And then right after that, she grabbed her cell phone and got Dennis Banks on the line and put him on speakerphone and had him just give some words of encouragement to all of the commissioners. And it had nothing to do with the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, because I suspect that whoever put the agenda together for that meeting, really wasn't thinking enough ahead to, like, I'm going to put these two things back to back, and we're going to have this cool juxtaposition. I think it was just sort of fortuitous that it happened this way. But they came up and they gave a PowerPoint presentation that's similar to what you might give to, like, the Chamber of Commerce when you're trying to talk up the jobs and things like that. And so there was a question and answer period afterwards. And one of the questions had to do with, like, you talk about all these jobs, but how are you going to offer jobs to our communities in ways that respect our cultural values? And the response was, we're going to teach your kids to work in the pipeline industry. And I was like, my God, did you not just watch this video that we all sat here and watched of the pipeline industry spraying Native people with fire hoses in the middle of the winter? And then you say that's the industry you're going to teach us to work in. So it was just, it was a really tone-deaf response. And I feel like, intentionally or not, that one little vignette like captured most of the interactions between developers and tribal leaders throughout this entire process. And, you know, they're not necessarily ill-intentioned towards Native people. They don't have the background and the context and the competence to understand our worldviews, our values, and where we're coming from. Mm-hmm. And Native people want economic development. They want jobs just like everybody else. You know, but we have a lot of other values that are in the mix alongside, you know, the dollar signs.
No, I think that's a fair way of describing the relationship between like these corporations and indigenous people when it comes to these like projects of economic development. It's like, we'll teach you how to become the traditional pipeliner. You know, the potential is there for like, you know, maybe the tribal government using some of these revenues to like fund a museum or something. I mean, I've seen instances of that in different communities using like revenue from oil extraction or just resource extraction to at least provide some of that. But for them to just blatantly do that right after is just pretty like, I guess, yeah, pretty tone deaf.
And I do, I want to shout out because, you know, tribal nations will always take a situation and turn it back towards something beneficial, right? Even if they are invested in oil and gas, many of them are using those funds to further initiatives, right? They're going to make the best of the situation. But if you're presented with the opportunity to have an extractive situation versus, you know, not having that industry in your territory, that's a whole separate discussion of like, we're in this situation now, like, what's the best possible outcome for us? We should be in a position to back up and have these discussions in the beginning about whether or not we want these industries in our communities in the first place.
Yeah, I think it's fair. When did it begin and what are some of the reasons why they chose to even start constructing it?
Yeah, so the public announcement was in the second half of 2014. That was around the time of the Dan River coal ash spill. And I don't know how much you know about this disaster, but you know, all these coal ash facilities all over the Southeast tend to be located next to rivers because the coal plants need that large water supply to generate electricity. And so, you know, for many decades, they stored all that waste on site. And in 2008, there was this massive coal ash spill in Tennessee. And then in 2013 or 2014, there was a large coal ash spill on the North Carolina-Virginia border on the Dan River. And that was like one of the death strokes, I think, for coal in North Carolina. We still have coal in the region, but everybody's known for years, it's on its way out. And so the companies, in looking to move past coal, looked to shale gas because that was during the big shale gas and fracking boom in West Virginia and Pennsylvania. So they said, oh, this is an easy way to dump coal because we can, you know, easily transition. You can even upfit coal-fired power plants to gas burning plants. And on paper, if you exclude all the fugitive methane emissions, it looks like a better proposition from greenhouse gas emissions as well. And so I think those factors and probably some others that I don't know about combined to cause them to plan this pipeline. And the developers are energy holding companies that have major electricity and gas utilities in North Carolina and Virginia. And so they built a pipeline mainly to supply their gas-fired power plants that they were hoping to build as replacements for coal. And so all of this discussion about we need gas for heating homes and industrial facilities in the eastern part of the state, those were like collateral benefits to the bulk of this project, which was to supply gas to electricity plants.
From what I've read, it seems like, and this is probably going to transition us into the next set of questions, but like Indigenous people were not necessarily considered people to ask in the first place. And were there any consultations between these corporations and Indigenous communities? You did tell a little story in the beginning, but were there any attempts to consult? I believe it's the Lumbee, the Kohiri, and maybe the Halawa Saponi tribes, because I believe those are the ones that are within 4 of the 8 counties that this pipeline was originally supposed to be constructed within.
Yeah, so first, in terminology, I don't like to use the word consultation when I talk about developer tribal interactions, because, I mean, you know the federal policy on consultation, and you and I could use that term, but I don't want your subscribers to get confused about what consultation means. So we could say engagement between corporations and tribes. And I would say prior to that meeting that I described, a lot of the engagement activities were the same kinds of things that you might do with garden clubs or like civic organizations. You know, you send them a letter, you send them a glossy brochure, and you offer to come and, you know, give the sales pitch. The work that I've done has been to document and create a timeline. This is recent work beyond the environmental justice analysis. I've recently created a timeline of Atlantic Coast Pipeline actions that were relevant to tribes. And there were some mailings and things like this that went out both from the developer and from federal regulators in like late 2014, 2015. But the closest meeting that I can find that was held early on was in, there was one in Fayetteville, which is like 40 miles away from the main part of the Lumbee community. I believe there was one in Rocky Mount, which was maybe 20 or 30 miles away from the Halawa Saponi center of their community. But these were not meetings that were aimed at tribal nations. They were like public hearings. In fact, by that time, federal regulators had changed their public hearing model to like instead of a hearing where you sit in a room and hear what people have to say, they had these little booths where you would go in individually and give your testimony, which is kind of strange when you think about like the democratization of discussions around infrastructure development.
It also feels like they're taking like cues from like Catholicism, or like, you know, when you have to like confess your sins and be like, "Dear Lord, I've sinned today. I do not approve of this pipeline."
Yeah. So I guess the short answer to your question is there was no tribal specific engagement early on, especially engagement that like acknowledged that, you know, tribes are governments and they represent tribal citizens. And, you know, that's largely because these are non-federally recognized tribes. And I would even argue that like the only reason you have government to government tribal engagement to begin with is because it's now required by law, right? Like before the National Historic Preservation Act was updated to mandate tribal consultation, and before the presidential executive order on tribal consultation, like there was no compulsion for agencies to do that. And so it didn't happen regularly.
That was going to be the next question, which was that the effects of like tribal or Indigenous nations not being recognized federally, and if there were any consequences or how that actually materialized. And it seems like you summed that up is that maybe it's just they don't take these state recognized tribes seriously. Let's start with, why did Indigenous people resist this pipeline in the first place?
Yeah, I could have seen this easily playing out a different way. where all of these tribal communities just kind of rolled over and said, you know, fine, you've done it to us for centuries. You know, we'll adapt and we're resilient and we'll keep moving. At some point during the process, 2016, around the time the environmental impact statement was being prepared, you know, it came out that the route really did cut through the heart of North Carolina's tribal communities. I can't speak as much about Virginia just because I'm not as intimately familiar with where all the Virginia tribes are located. But you couldn't pick a route in North Carolina that impacted more Native people, right? And so, like, I think people were outraged that there were so many Native people in the federally defined impact area, yet there was no discussion of that whatsoever in the draft environmental impact statement. I did a word search on that document, you know, and my PDF reader. And the word Lumbee was mentioned, I want to say like four or five times, and all but one of those were references to a soil type that's called Lumbee, right? So it was just, I think if it had not been so egregious, like just from that standpoint of erasure, people wouldn't have been so outraged about it. But I really think that the erasure aspect had a lot to do with it here, because in the Southeast, if you want to get Native people pissed off about something, can I say that? If you want Native people to be pissed off about something, you know, erase them from an official proceeding.
Prior to this, I was looking at the statement that the Atlanta Pipeline put out to see if there were any mentions of their statement as to why they're discontinuing the construction of the pipeline. And, you know, I put in, you know, indigenous, tribal, you know, nation, native, nothing came up. Once the indigenous nations in North Carolina got pissed off about erasure, how did they start to like resist it? From your point of view, how were indigenous people like mobilizing or getting involved with resisting this pipeline?
You had a lot of individual tribal citizens engaging with their elected officials, tribal council members, chiefs, tribal chair people. So individuals were getting upset about this, and they were following, you know, these somewhat colonial practices of going to your elected official and complaining about it. And I think enough people complained, and they didn't just complain, they showed up with evidence. They said, these are the ways that we're being ignored. Around that time, I'd started sharing some very specific numbers about the disparities and the number of Native people in the study area, and shared those freely, you know, with folks all over the state. Some of that information was disseminated through the Commission of Indian Affairs Environmental Justice Committee. And what a lot of the tribes did was they went ahead and drafted formal letters for the public comment portion of the environmental impact statement. And so they said, we read the environmental impact statement and we see that we're not in it, even though you're cutting through all of our territories. You need to acknowledge that we're here. And then you also need to like pause the environmental review process and come and talk to us about any of the unique concerns that we might have and incorporate those into the environmental impact statement before you make a decision on this pipeline. And so that happened in early 2017. And that was the result of people from lots of different tribes going to their leaders and saying, you need to do this to make sure we're not erased in this like really massive infrastructure project that you know, could reshape this region. And to their credit, when they wrote those letters, you know, the tribal officials and the other leaders, they didn't say like, we hate this pipeline and you need to cancel it. They're like, you haven't come and talked to us or engaged with us enough for us to have any opinion at all on the merits of this thing. But we do know that it's wrong for you to leave us out of the process.
Do you think that there's any coincidence that both of these pipelines happen to just be canceled in the same week?
I don't know. And, you know, the scary thing about Dakota Access is that it's not fully canceled. It's just deactivated until they go through the process that they should have gone through the first time and make a new decision. So, like, the thing that worries me about Dakota Access is that at some point in the future, that infrastructure is there and they could open the valve and they could be allowed to resume operations there. I don't know if there's any deeper connection there. I've been following the court case associated with Dakota Access, and I knew that Judge Boasberg was due to issue this opinion because he wrote a few months ago that the Corps of Engineers had not followed protocol in preparing the environmental review, but he withheld he didn't say at that time what the penalty would be. He said he needed more time to think about like whether or not the pipeline should be shut off. And so everyone who was watching this case knew that he was due to release a decision on that matter. I don't know if there's any significance in the fact that it was timed a day after Atlantic Coast Pipeline.
That's something that I thought was really interesting. I mean, I was elated with optimism and I was pretty happy, but then thinking back, I was like, I wonder if there's any connection between this. Granted, there probably isn't. It just, you know, happened to be the moment. But I like to think maybe that there's like a group of like corporations that meet up and are like, yeah, we're going to cancel this week. Is anybody else going to cancel? You know, like,
Keystone and Atlantic Coast Pipeline were together on the court action that was related to the Nationwide 12 permit. So basically, like, all of those companies got together and petitioned the Ninth Circuit Court and then the Supreme Court to free them up to use this expedited permit. So I know that, like, yeah, sometimes they do get together and pursue legal actions. I don't know what other discussions they have when they're in the room together.
I mean, I even just imagined it as like a text message where it's like, hey, we're canceling this week. Are y'all canceling? You know, but, you know, those are just little daydreams that I have. Now, what does this, the ending of Atlantic Pipeline mean for, or what does this win for, what does it mean for Indigenous people in the region? But I mean, if you can maybe speak to the U.S. as well. What this win means for Indigenous people.
I think this is really big for state recognized tribes in North Carolina because they have so many external limitations to their exercise of sovereignty that they need to, our leaders need to see and understand that they can exercise their sovereignty in different ways. Even if federal regulators don't recognize it, they have power and influence that they can exert. And I think that they're seeing how to do that. And the Atlantic Coast Pipeline taught our leaders that they have muscles to flex. And I'm sure, you know, they know this already, and they've done this in other realms related to education and healthcare and these other fields. I really hadn't seen that happen before in an area related to the environment, you know, which is interesting because you would think that would be central to our interests and to who we are and what we want to protect. So I think that was a big boost, but there needs to be some processing and connecting the dots to make sure that tribal citizens and tribal leaders understand how they were able to exert that influence and that power. And this is, I definitely do not mean to downplay like the massive work that other communities put into this, like the community in Union Hill, Virginia, or folks in Northampton County, North Carolina. These are both predominantly African-American communities where there was really strong resistance to the big compressor stations that they had just decided to plop down, you know, in the middle of these counties. They really led the organizing and a lot of the national networking on this, and that was super important. And you know, they built alliances with groups up and down the pipeline route. So this is not, the Atlantic Coast Pipeline is like not a singular story about how indigenous peoples saved the day, right? I mean, we were part of a much larger network that came together and was focused on the singular issue of stopping this infrastructure for a lot of different reasons. I think it was really cool, and Melinda Lowry from UNC had a nice tweet about, you know, what unity looks like when people are together and they're aimed on a singular purpose and can overcome all these differences to make something happen. I think what she's, you know, she really cut to the heart of it. As far as Indian country more broadly, I think there are still some connections to be made. And there are other people who I think could maybe do a better job of exploring that. I'm hoping to do a little bit of that in my work. I want to think a little bit about connections between Atlantic Coast Pipeline and Dakota Access Pipeline, and maybe some of the actions that have happened in the Pacific Northwest while I'm away from NC State next year writing. But I definitely think they're there. I think we need to understand that there are ways other than like these federal laws and federal policies around tribal consultation where Native people can get involved and play major roles.